Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. All of these many months, even years of election mania, will soon come down to one thing: the counting of the votes of some 140 million Americans. But the results will only be as good as the accuracy of the counting of those votes. Today, the methods used to count votes vary widely, from the most primitive system of counting by hand to highly automated computer counting. But do these methods have an impact on outcome? Is there reason to worry as more and more votes are counted in cyberspace? In an era when our finances and banking, our bills, our communication, and even our taxes are all conducted online and in the cloud, why should we worry about votes being counted the same way? Well, my guest, Jonathan Simon, worries a great deal about that. Jonathan Simon is Executive Director of Election Defense Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to restoring observable vote counting and electoral integrity. He's also the author of Code Red, Computerized Election Theft in the New American Century. Jonathan Simon, welcome to Radio Who, What, Why.
Thanks, Jeff. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. In a world in which we do so much online, we trust it with our finances, our taxes, almost every aspect of our lives now is conducted online. Why should we feel differently with respect to voting and elections?
That's a great opening question. When we go down to the bank and we use an ATM or we send in a check or whatever, we have a certain amount of faith in the functioning of the computers and in the honesty of the institutions that we're dealing with. But if that faith is somehow betrayed or undermined, we're going to get an indication of that. We're going to see a bank statement. We're going to get a receipt from the ATM. We're going to get a credit card statement. And we're going to jump all over it, as people will do. So, the difference with voting is that once that ballot is cast, you don't get a receipt, and you certainly don't get any indication of how all the other votes are being counted. So it's basically a black box and entirely faith-based process where there isn't going to be an indication if there has been either error, glitch, or fraud. You're not going to see it, and you're just going to take those electoral results on blind faith.
What about in situations where there's so much polling today, both pre-polling and exit polling, and there's consistency of results between what the polls might indicate, what the results might be, and what exit polling will show?
Yeah, well, if there were consistency of results, indeed, we would be something that we'd have to look at and try to understand. And in fact, there is a feedback loop that tends to generate some consistency of results. Polling firms are not in business to get elections wrong, so they keep tweaking their sampling and their methodology based on electoral results. That having been said, there's great inconsistencies. In fact, if you looked at the Democratic primaries in 2016, for instance, the exit polls in state after state after state were shifted, and all in the same direction, basically. Then you looked on the Republican side, and they were basically spot on. So we have, what we call forensics, and unfortunately, forensics can be fairly eye-glazing, and it may be an exercise in futility trying to prove that these elections have been manipulated. But the forensics are pretty strong year after year after year. They came up very hot in the 2016 primaries. And again, it's more than just this exit poll or that pre-election poll being off from the results. It's a consistent pattern, and what we call second-order comparisons are particularly strong. And by that, I mean it's not just that the exit polls were off in this, and this race on the Democratic side. It's that they performed brilliantly on the Republican side, being administered by the same firm, Edison Research, on the same day with the same questions being asked by the same questioners at the same precincts. And when you're looking at the Republican races and Republican voters, they did splendidly. And when you're looking at the Democratic ones, it was so far off that they had to cancel the last three or four exit polls because they were frankly embarrassed by the consistent miss in state after state after state. And, of course, it was pretty much all in the same direction.
And if there's partisan movement behind any manipulation of election, why would you be seeing it to that degree in a primary?
Oh, well, you know, there are some pretty strong motives to control the field of candidates. And as a matter of fact, I mean, the fact that we saw it in the Democratic primaries is pretty strong corroboration, in a way, of that that motivation. I mean, Bernie Sanders, and I'm going to leave my own partisanship out of this and just be sort of an objective analyst looking at, you know, how the country is viewing these horse races. Bernie Sanders was the one candidate, you know, in the major parties, who basically was threatening to the corporate elites. I mean, he was the outlier as far as what would be brought to the table in a general election. And so, you know, eliminating him from contention could be seen as a very strong partisan, not necessarily Democratic versus Republican, but if you look at it from, let's say, the 1% versus the 99%, or the corporate control versus, you know, the populist sentiment, there was very, very strong motivation to take him out of the running. And, you know, so when you control the field, and this goes not just for presidential politics, but it goes down to the level of the House of Representatives or state legislatures. The infrastructure of American politics is built not in the White House. It's been, you know, the White House tends to be more transient. The more permanent, and there are many reasons for this, gerrymandering and advantages of incumbency, but the more permanent infrastructure is built at the state legislative level. It's built in the U.S. House of Representatives. When you control the field for those races, that's a huge part of controlling the outcomes. If you're not giving voters the choice that they would otherwise have. So primaries turn out to be, A, extremely important in the overall outcome of our elections, and they tend to escape scrutiny. They don't tend to be exit polled to the same degree. The turnout is less. The media attention is less. So this, you know, provides a very good illustration of how somebody with either an outcome vision of how they want the you know, the political structure of America to look, or a lot of money to spend and a client who has a view of how they want things to come out, one of the, you know, chief targets would be primary elections.
If that were true, though, if in fact the corporate elite were somehow manipulating results for Bernie Sanders not to be victorious, certainly on the Republican side, you could make the case that they were far more attractive candidates in the Republican field to corporate interests than the one that ultimately won.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, I in a sense, walk straight into the trap, because when we're trying to deal with who did it, why did they do it, how did they do it, we get off into a lot of speculation. You know, is it a cadre? Is it the Russians? Is it Karl Rove? Is it, you know, a group of true believers? Is it the moneyed interest? Is it the Koch brothers? And we can't answer those questions. They're, you know, that would be a challenge for, let's say, an FBI investigation. I mean, we don't have the resources. I mean, we can speculate. But fundamentally, we don't know. We don't know what the game plan is. We don't know what, you know, masterminds could be thinking, whether it's foreign or domestic. We can safely say the enough forces out there, given the stakes involved in American elections and in American politics and the impact on the whole world and on certainly on the financial sector as well, you can well imagine that there could be those who have a stake, have a horse in the race, and have the money to spend. The key problem is really not who did it. We're not looking to rerun any past elections, you know, take George Bush out of office or make Bernie Sanders the Democratic nominee. The key problem is the vulnerability of the system. So, you know, we can go one of two ways. I mean, it can spend a lot of time and energy trying to proves that election theft has happened, and because we're denied access to all the hard evidence, the actual voter mark ballots, the memory cards, the code, corporate correspondence, all of that is off limits, it becomes a very difficult thing to do. I mean, you wind up with statistical patterns, and you work pretty hard at making sense of those patterns and drawing some conclusions. But at the end of the day, it remains circumstantial evidence. So when we fall into the trap, and I found this, more and more. I began with forensics back in 2002, and I've been doing it for a long time, and I have some colleagues who have been doing it for a long time. And we think doing it pretty well and amassing a pretty, strong just mountains of evidence. But at the end of the day, the real the takeaway from all that is this is a hell of a stupid risk to take, to have votes be counted unobservably, outsourced to private corporations of whatever partisanship, to have the votes counted essentially behind a cyber curtain and to trust those results in an age where, you've got the state nations doping their athletes, you've got, the steroids, you've got Volkswagen, cheating through the programming of the computers in their cars. I mean, you just have so many examples of where the stakes are high. And nobody can look, that the ethics don't step up to the challenge, and that advantage is taken of these vulnerabilities. And that really is the issue. Can we go forward with this unobservable vote counting system and trust it? And part of the problem now is that trust is breaking down. Whatever I think, whatever you think, and however you would view Trump as an avatar of electoral integrity, the bottom line is that trust is breaking down, and people are getting to the point where they're not likely to accept electoral outcomes, and that's true whether manipulation has taken place or not. And the problem there is that the vote counting process is unobservable.
Given the diversity of systems that exist in the country, given that vote counting takes place on essentially a county level, on a local level, with different systems, different officials, talk a little bit about the impact of that, and isn't that some kind of a bulwark against the kind of manipulation we're talking about?
Yeah, Jeff, Obama, our president, made precisely that point, and I have a lot of respect for his intelligence, and he rarely says things that have me scratching my head, and this was one of them, because in fact the system is not very diverse. It's a few corporations that supply virtually all of the equipment. The administrators, on whether it's on the state or the county or the precinct level, generally don't have the technical chops to really monitor that equipment or keep track of what's going on in it. So they rely on the vendors and the vendor satellite corporations to basically do the programming, do the testing in the vast majority of cases. So it really wouldn't take much of a sophisticated operation to get to know what machines are running where, what their vulnerabilities are, how to take advantage of those vulnerabilities, and it wouldn't take a big operation to provide malicious code in memory cards or in central tabulators. The diversity, the fact that we haven't federalized elections doesn't make it any more difficult for somebody looking and planning how to target various elections and steal those elections. The equipment is all very, very, very vulnerable. And again, this is something that could be done, this is a scary thought, but really a high school level programmer. I'm not an IT specialist, but I know quite a few, and check this out with them. This is not something that requires a tremendous amount of sophistication. I'll just give you an example. You want to change the results of, let's say, a House race. What you could do, and it's probably the simplest of all manipulations, is change the zero counters. So you have an optical scan machine, you know, the kind that most of us mm-hmm. are familiar with voting on, and you have about 500 to 700,000 lines of code on that memory card that interprets the ballot and tabulates the votes. With three lines of code, you can change the zero counters. And what does that mean? That means that, let's say you have Clinton Sanders and you want Clinton to win, you basically set Clinton's zero counter to plus X, let's say plus 100. You set Sanders' zero counter to minus 100. This takes, as I said, about three lines of code out of 500,000 on the memory card. At the end of the day, what happens is that the total number of votes, it's a wash. You got plus 100 here, you got minus 100 there. So the machine registers the right number of votes to match the number of voters who signed the poll book. The election administrator looks at that and says, looks good to me, certifies the election, and you've just shifted a net of 200 votes. It's basically undetectable, and you could do it in self-deleting code, but you really wouldn't even have to bother since nobody other than the corporation has access to that memory card. PDQ, you know, that's per machine. So you do that in, I don't know, 100 machines, and you've got 20,000 votes shifted, and you've just changed the outcome of a competitive race. That's a scary thought. I mean, there are other ways of manipulating that are also pretty much child's play.
Do we need to be looking at, if not hand ballots or observable counting, do we need to be looking at more logic and accuracy, independent logic and accuracy testing, observable testing of these machines before they and after they count votes?
Well, testing has always been a problem and a bit of a sore point since, you know, as with many industries, the testing process is often in-house or, you know, committed to labs that are being paid by the vendors. So that's the fact of the testing, which happens at this point. I mean, there is testing. But what's tested 3 months before an election or even a week before an election doesn't indicate what's going to run on election day. Again, these are computers, and we know what you can do with computers, and they can pass a test with flying colors, you know, and then literally, you know, minutes later run a completely different program. So, you know, again, if we did that, we'd be asking the citizens and the voters to basically believe that this testing process was taking care of the problem and of the vulnerabilities, and I don't think that again, it just becomes another level of trust. What we really need is public observation, where, you know, there is the opportunity to not just count the votes, but to observe the count being done and to reconcile that through, you know, a reconciliation tree from the lowest level, the precinct level, all the way up to the county level and the state level, and to be able to ensure that the ballots are cast in private but are counted in public. This is a public trust. And that's the fundamental principle here. Whose ballots are they? Who owns these ballots? Why do they become corporate property and off limits to all inspection or investigation? You know, I often these days draw the parallel to Deflategate, because, you know, there the footballs were impounded and the cell phones were impounded and millions of dollars were spent investigating how much is the air pressure is in those footballs. Was Tom Brady cheating? And, you know, you look at this and you say, are we living in reality or are we living in Wonderland, as in Alice in Wonderland? Because football matters. You know, it's headlines for over a year. The investigation is thorough. And in the case of elections, I mean, are the stakes that much less? Do we view the stakes of elections as being somehow less than victories and losses and yards gained in football. And this is, you know, this crazy inversion of priorities. And now, Jeff, the chickens are coming home to roost because we're seeing the breakdown of our political system right before our eyes. And, you know, we maintain, those of us who have been looking at, you know, election integrity and taking this problem seriously, that a big part of that breakdown is the distortion of the public will that takes place when you don't count elections honestly and accurately, when you don't count votes honestly and accurately, when it's not observable, when it's been outsourced. We as citizens have not just the right to an observable count, we have the duty to be participants in that process. If we really want a democracy, we've got to work for it. And we can't just prioritize ease, convenience, entertainment. Hey, I want to go vote. I want to go home. I want to watch, you know, NBC or Fox or whatever it is and see all the blinking charts and be told who the president is and who our government is, you know, go to bed at 10 o'clock. You know, this is lazy. And democracies were never sustained by lazy publics. So a big part of it is on us. Yes, the media has led the way. The media has made this about entertainment, about speed. It, you know, another Super Bowl. Basically, that's what it's become, another entertainment event. If we continue to look at it that way, we're going to continue to get the kind of, you know, warped, stuffed animal of democracy rather than the real thing that we're seeing now reflected in this election.
In Florida in 2000, we had very much the observable counting of ballots. That didn't work out too well. Is that some kind of a touchstone that we should look at?
Well, Florida 2000 is really interesting because the investigations, you know, that have been done by such as Greg Palast and, you know, and others at the time, you know, indicated that there was a certain amount of How should I call it, sandbagging or self-sabotage of the counting system through the punch cards and the kind of paper that it was done on, whatever, that led to this debacle, you know, this very, I guess, iconic photograph of some poor guy looking through a magnifying glass at the ballots and, you know, how silly that all looked. And then that, of course, gave rise to the Help America Vote Act and the computerization of American elections. So, you know, it had the result, if not the intention, it certainly had the result of saying, well, we can't do this anymore. We have to computerize everything. And we went from the frying pan into the fire. When you're counting ballots under those conditions, when you have political I guess thugs would be the best word for it, pounding on the windows, when you have the kind of magnifying glass and you have the kind of suspicions that were going on down in Palm Beach and in Miami and, you know, in Florida, and you're not prepared for it. There was no preparation. It was something that just sort of sprung out of the emergency of the situation. It's not going to look very good. It's going to be hard to organize. As a matter of fact, you know, a lot of recounts that are done, not that that many recounts are done, but when they're done, it's also very difficult because they really haven't been prepared very well. This is something that you'd have to build a culture and set up and organize a restoration of a normal process of vote counting. And yes, we have to probably wait past 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night. We might have to wait till the next day or maybe even 2 days to get the full results. And yes, it could be contentious. Politics are contentious. But I think those 2 days are worth spending to have a public that says, okay, we know that either I myself or representatives of my interest were able to watch this counting process. It didn't take place behind a curtain. It wasn't outsourced to a few corporations that, you know, are basically unvetted. We now have real confidence in the electoral results, which is evaporating very quickly. And I mean, you know, again, there are other countries in the world, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and there's quite a long list now that came to exactly that conclusion and basically said, computerized vote counting is very convenient, but we can't trust it anymore. And they went back to a hand count, observable vote counting process.
Is there an argument to be made for going to the extreme opposite? A computerized system, an online system that's nationalized, that everybody partakes in, that is checked and checked and rechecked again and independently monitored. Do we need to go to the other extreme as a way to accomplish both security and speed?
Yeah, that's also a good question. I am not, as I said, I'm not an IT expert, nor, that's not my profession. However, what we hear from the people who are IT experts and who are working on this is that reliable, truly verifiable internet voting is decades away, if ever. And the reason for that is that in the world, in the cyber world, pretty much the minute you make something secure, there's someone out there that's going to undermine that. And we've seen examples of that. We've seen examples of that with the Pentagon, the IMF, the credit card companies. I mean, institutions that have literally billions of dollars to spend on encryption and security and have gone really to the moon and back to make their system secure and then have been hacked. So the idea of internet voting is very appealing on many fronts. It would, make voting more convenient. It would probably increase turnout. It sounds great. We do everything else online. But the experts pretty much are unanimous in saying that we're not there yet. And a good proportion of those experts say we may never get there, or certainly not in the short term. So the other little gloss on internet voting, because my colleagues are, I would say, horrified by the thought and universally against it, and I, weighed in being something of a contrarian and said, well, wait a minute. Okay, the voting system that we have now is the equivalent of what the mafia would call a closed city. The opportunities for manipulation are very strongly concentrated in those who run the process, in those four, five, six corporations. Ironically, we're now worrying about Russian hackers and whatnot, but the real danger, very hard to acknowledge since we tend to externalize our enemies, but the real danger is insider, because that's where the access is. So the access is very strong, and it's very limited right now to these insiders. If you had internet voting, you would kind of open up the city, mm-hmm. in the mafia idea of an open city. Anybody can come in and rig to their heart's content. So you'd have given the security in place at this point, you'd have a kind of free-for-all. You'd have rigging and counter-rigging and thwarting and God knows what. To me, in certain ways, that's better than what we have now, because at least the whole thing would blow up relatively quickly, and people would say, well, we can't trust this system, and it's very obvious. It would also be obvious to people, if you were voting on computer at home, that it was actually a computerized system. I think right now there's a lot of misunderstanding. When people put their ballot into an op-scan machine, they don't necessarily see that as a computer. It looks very safe. Well, I marked my ballot. It still exists. And here it goes into the slot. And there's no computer involved. Well, an optical scanner, just like a touch screen, is a computer. It's a fairly sophisticated computer. It then, you know, those results get digitized. They get sent off to a central tabulator, which is an even more sophisticated computer. They get piped through to the Associated Press on an even more sophisticated computer. So the system right now is very much computerized. The access to the actual voter mark ballots is nil. So they exist, but it's false reassurance because they never, when I say never, 99.99% of the time will never see the light of day. So we're on a computerized system now, and it's a system that, again, there's very close control of what goes into it, and that control is very much in the hands of a few private corporations.
Certainly, historically, there was voter fraud and election rigging long before there were optical scanning machines. Doesn't the system require inherently a certain amount of trust, a certain amount of faith, whether it's observable counting, whether it's optical scanning, or something in the future?
Well, yeah, elections are high-stakes affairs, and where you have high-stakes affairs, there's certainly an incentive to cheat. The difference is, and this was best put by a Republican, IT pro, whose name was Chuck Herron, and I'm going to paraphrase, but he basically said, and I can't do the Southern drawl, but he basically said, it takes a long time to change 10,000 votes by hand. It takes me 3 seconds to do it in a computer. And that's the main difference, is that the old, what we called retail fraud, we have examples from 1960, right. JFK and in Illinois, and obviously and Lyndon Johnson and his race, and in Texas, there are pretty much established examples of ballot box stuffing and people voting twice or 50 times or whatever. That was basically equal opportunity. It was very labor intensive. It took a lot of effort to generate, even a relatively small move of the needle. Very difficult to cover up, so it was pretty much overt. And by and large, a wash, because both parties could do it. Anybody was pretty much free to do it. Now, locally, it wasn't a wash, because if you had control of the South, or you had control of a state or of a city, you were going to have much more power to do this. But when you looked at it on balance in terms of the direction that America, was taking as a whole, it was pretty much equal opportunity. It was retail. It was very, modest in terms of the limitations of what you could do. What we have now is just the opposite. It's very much directional, because the control of these companies is, if you go through their pedigree, it's quite partisan. So the opportunity is much more limited, much more directional. And the overall efficiency, the impact, is orders of magnitude greater. A single person, and this has been established, this is not, the stuff of conspiracy theory, this is the Brennan Center and Princeton, Caltech and the GAO, that it really, a single person could change dozens, if not hundreds, of electoral results. That you don't require the big labor force to do it. It's relatively, it's very efficient process. So the dangers are not only much more directional in the sense that there's a partisan element to it, much, much greater in magnitude. And we think, when we've looked at the forensics from 2002 forward, we see a pretty consistent pattern illustrated by the what we call the red shift, where it does voting results, electoral results come out to the right of exit polls, pre-election polls, hand counts, you name it, pretty much on a very, very consistent basis with just a very, very, very few exceptions. And in most cases, those exceptions, there was something identifiable to explain it. The overall pattern is very consistently one-sided, and it does appear to correlate with control over the vote counting process.
And to what extent, finally, Jonathan, do you think that this issue is going to be front and center in 48 more days?
Hard, you know, that's a bit of a cloudy crystal ball, because a lot of it depends on how things go. I mean, I took Code Red up to basically the beginning of September. And my prediction in there, I mean, you know, and it includes a call to action to how we could go about, you know, reclaiming the sovereignty, reclaiming the control of this, you know, process of make it observable. But it's pretty much resigned to the fact that this isn't going to happen in the next 48 days. And so we're looking at an election that where there's already been a lot of rumbling of mistrust. And again, you know, our work is really not to identify the perpetrator and say, well, Hillary's going to rig this or Trump's going to rig this or that's not it. It's basically identifying the fact that the system is an incredibly at-risk system, and that, you know, what we're seeing now is reports of concern about hacking, the NSA getting involved to try to, you know, set up a task force to control the process, which, again, is a double-edged sword. You know, that degree of centralization could be very scary for those who look at a country, for instance, like Russia, and say, yeah, they got control of their elections, all right. You know, Putin will never lose. That's a scary thought. It's hard. It's hard to represent the public and the public interest without turning it over to, you know, the same insiders that could be very inimical to that interest. It's hard for the public to get together and assert their rights in an organized way. So we're looking, you know, conceptually at a very difficult situation. Pragmatically, it wouldn't be all that hard to count our votes observably. But the inertias that are in place are very, very strong. It's going to take some serious, serious public commitment to change this process. And what's going to happen in 2016? I don't know. Most of us naturally, you know, tend to focus, when I say us, the public tends to be riveted on the presidential race. We think, you know, most of the real damage has been done from a forensics evidence standpoint down ballot. Down in the House of Representatives, down in state legislatures. So, you know, an election like 2014 goes under the radar and everybody, you know, just sort of moves along, where elections like 2004 and potentially this year generate a lot of interest, a lot of concern. But as for what's going to happen and who's going to scream foul, if they're going to scream foul, and whether anything constructive will come out of that, you know, I'm going to sit back with you and, you know, sort of await developments. I have to say, you know, it's not an encouraging place in terms of what has become of not just, you know, political dialogue, but the entire political process. You've got a lot of angry people out there. You've got a lot of angry Bernie Sanders supporters. You have a lot of potentially angry people from whoever loses this election, and trust is really breaking down. And I think, you know, really the way to restore that trust is to make the process observable. At the very least, institute a well-designed and a transparent audit process, which could operate as a deterrent. I'd like to see hand-counted paper ballots. I think it could be very communal, very congregational, a way of coming together after elections. People do very well, you know. It depends on circumstances, you know. I mean, white people and black people get together and do very well in one circumstance, and they become enemies in another circumstance. I mean, this has, you know, been established by sociologists. In a similar kind of way, Democrats, Republicans, right-wingers, left-wingers can be, you know, the bitterest enemies in certain circumstances. But if you make the right circumstances, you put them in a room together and give them a task to do and say, hey, we're all Americans here. We're all people who care about this country. Then you bring out the best in those people. And I see hand counting as something along those lines, where people of very differing views come together to participate in a process and participate in it fairly. And, you know, perhaps that's absurdly idealistic, but if we can't get there, then I don't know where we really can get as a nation. So I see it as a very healing prospect. That having been said, you know, if we can't get to hand-counted paper ballots, we at least need a much, much stronger system of audits and recounts and access to ballots as public records. What we're seeing instead is that more and more states, especially the states taken over by Republicans, you know, at the legislative and the administrative level, are taking ballots and removing them from public records access. They're exempting ballots from public records law. So it's becoming less transparent, less of an opportunity to observe directly what should be really a part of the public domain. So, you know, we're moving in certain ways in the right direction, but certainly not fast enough. And there's a very strong countercurrent, both with regard to voter suppression, which, you know, we know about. Greg Palast has done remarkable work in that area. It's now, you know, certainly made it to the courts. The courts are looking at it, and they're, you know, recognizing voter suppression and the cynicism of that. We are, you know, in many ways going in the wrong direction, and it's showing up in the kind of politics that we're being, you know, that's being foisted on us at this point.
Jonathan Simon, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.